This is a podcast for those interested in medicine, in particular, young and aspiring doctors. So if you're considering or starting a career in medicine, you've come to the right place. Mentors in Medicine is brought to you by Adventist Healthcare, the operators of New South Wales' largest private hospital, Sydney Adventist Hospital, commonly known as the SAN. We're lucky to have a world-class team of healthcare professionals right on our doorstep, and they have plenty of wisdom to share. So, in this podcast, we'll be asking our doctors what they wish they'd known before embarking on their medical careers. What pitfalls do they wish they could have avoided? And what insights can they pass on to help our next generation of doctors navigate the journey ahead? Before we start, just a quick note that the medical information communicated in this podcast is of a general educational nature only. Adventist Healthcare does not assume liability for the accuracy or completeness of the information provided and the opinions of the guests interviewed. We hope you enjoy Mentors in Medicine. Thanks for listening. Now, on with the show.
Welcome to the SANS podcast series on what I wish I knew before I became a doctor.
If junior doctors didn't have support, it can become really stressful, and that's the thing to understand as a surgeon, that if your registrar is not available as a consultant, that it's your job to provide that service for the hospital that you work in.
Joining us today is Associate Professor Paya Mukherjee, an adult and paediatric ear, nose and throat surgeon in Sydney, specialising in advanced ear surgery, cochlear implants and lateral skull-based surgery. Her research specialises in ear bionics using 3D printing and bioprinting. She was awarded the prestigious Royal Australasian College of Surgeons Michael Donnellan Medal for outstanding contribution to the art and science of surgery. She is passionate about gender equity in surgery, as well as developing STEM skills, that is, science, technology, engineering and mathematics skills, in young girls. Pyle was awarded a Women in Surgery Leadership Award in 2022. We're really looking forward to hearing about your insights about medical training and how you embarked on this career path, including building a thriving career as a woman in medicine. As a young woman in medicine, you were probably not in equal numbers with men and women in your cohort. Is that right?
Yeah, I must say medical school was different, but as I was fairly certain very early on that I wanted to do surgery, but surgery was a different ballgame with respect to numbers. There were very few women when I was interested in surgery.
Why do you think that is?
Many reasons. There's overt and covert barriers. So surgery is seen as a not family-friendly profession with long hours and sacrifices, personal sacrifices. But what I was surprised, the bigger barrier for me were actual colleagues, often physicians, telling me when I, as a junior doctor, when I expressed my interest to do surgery, for them to sort of tell me that that was not a good profession for females. So that was actually, I was more surprised, and there were surgical colleagues who were encouraging me to do so. So reflecting back on that, that if somebody was to say that to an intern today, I would be most disappointed, but I was surprised that that's actually still happens. I think that that's a much bigger barrier for women entering the profession, the what you think will happen rather than what really does happen.
So leaning on past observations of what medical training was like and then projecting it on the women today currently who are in practice or yearning to do surgery, how did you get around changing that in your environment?
I just think that visibility has been a huge part of that change. There weren't any or many female role models, and certainly none that I could, you know, have a cup of coffee with whilst I was an intern. Now, with more women not only being around but actually being visible and also being in a position of leadership in surgery, I think that's a real game changer. We actively engage with medical students, do talks with several medical schools, whether we're affiliated with the university or not. In the Women in Surgery forums for the medical students is a really strategic aspect of that. And of course, through academia, through having students, you know, in supervising them through research, So that's the point of entry for junior doctors who are interested in a career in surgery. And then also to make sure that you have mentorship when you do have females who are surgical trainees, to make sure that they don't get, you know, burnt out in the process.
There's a lot of discussion in the media right now about doctor burnout, particularly young doctors. Can you share a bit about what your experience was like when you started out, and is there any way you can be prepared for what was expected of you?
When we're going through it ourselves, we feel that it's difficult, but I think in some ways it's even more difficult now, and that's not been assisted by some changes in the system. So when I was going through it, I did an undergraduate medical degree, which took 6 years. I then went through internship. At the time, it was basic surgical training, which was 2 years, did a year of advanced training in general surgery, and then got on to ENT the year after. That would be unheard of now. So when I finished, and that was the norm for my peer group, that I was in my early 30s. But now most people, by the time they've finished surgery, they're in their late 30s, early 40s. So that creates a huge amount of pressure for men as well as women, because, you know, it's the phase of your life where you're committing to a family and children, and we all know that it doesn't matter what your career goals are, your kids always take first preference. So it creates more stress, I think, in the current generation of trainees. The systems sort of become more complicated because the majority of medical courses are now postgraduate rather than undergraduate. That delays the process. And then the volume of medical graduates coming out means there's more competition, but the places for surgical training has not increased. So there are system-based pressures that have nothing to do with the quality of the graduates. What the advantage is the graduates coming in have, they're better leaders, they have more skills. You don't finish your training and then learn skills. You're actually learning it along the way. So when I engage with the medical students and the junior doctors, I mean, a lot of them already have PhDs or doing PhDs as they go, but they also have, you know, tremendous leadership skills. They have, you know, there's this amazing network of medical students who've done phenomenal international clinical trials. That sort of stuff was unimaginable when we were going through it. So I think there are some advantages, but there's also disadvantages. Ultimately, what will mitigate burnout, which is the pressures that's, you know, the life pressures that the system's created, is to have a network and to really celebrate the successes that our junior colleagues are having so early on their life, and put the focus that it's not necessarily, you know, to have a path helps, be on a program helps. It's the uncertainty that creates stress. But to drive value in the work that they do early on and celebrate that will hopefully help mitigate some of that burnout. And then again, mentorship, like, you know, when you do take a student on and as a higher degree, or you're supervising them, you know, really sort of, you know, bat for them and increase the amount of exposure they have to opportunities through that program, make that as enjoyable as possible for them, will hopefully mitigate some of that stress.
Having a mentor to guide you through that, what were some of the qualities of a mentor, your really good mentors that you had that stuck with you and you said, I'm going to commit to doing that when I mentor the next generation?
The skills that you learn from the mentor in the craft, that's obviously important, like, you know, how do you do research? But for me, other things that I learned was how they navigate. So the diplomacy around, you know, conflict resolution or problem resolution, how all of the mentors that I've had were amazing team workers, and they had a network, and they also had leadership skills. So I think those sort of things was very exciting. And for me, it's those non-technical skills that are, you know, important to pass through, and, you know, hopefully, you know, I get better and better at passing them and teaching them on as I have more experience in mentorship over the years.
Teaching sounds like it's something that you enjoy doing and you're really passionate about. Why should young doctors keep this in mind as something to do at some stage in their careers?
Surgery is a pay it forward craft. Someone teaches us. The only way you learn to, so it's still, you know, it's like an apprenticeship model, right? It hasn't changed, never going to change. So we have to have, like, the only way you learn is because somebody's taught you. The only way you get better is because you failed and someone said, it's all right, this is how you get over that complication, or this is how you navigate the barrier in your either a technical or a non-technical component. We still, you know, even as specialists, still have colleagues we call on for help when we have difficult cases, you know. So the only way you can pass on surgery is by taking that goodwill off somebody who's invested that in you and passing it to somebody else who's then going to pass it to somebody else. The only reward really for you in the next generation is seeing that person's career fulfill and for them to become the leader of our next generation. So if you want to be a surgeon, you've got to, you know, it's part and parcel of being a teacher.
You mentioned just then about occasions where sometimes you fail and you fall over. In any job, you make mistakes. In medicine, however, there's so much more pressure and the stakes can be higher. Is there an example you can share when you've had something not go as planned or something that was out of your control? And how would you counsel a doctor who maybe has experienced that? How did you get through it?
Oh, when I was an intern, one of my worst days was when I was a young orthopedic intern and I came onto the ward. My registrar had just sort of, you know, done a quick round and, you know, given me the jobs. But one of the patients had fallen over at night and he had a GCS of 3. And the problem is I was in a specialist hospital and that whole day I spent going from system to system, but there was no general physician who catered for the under 75, because over 75, at least you had geriatrics to call. Under 75, there was no general physician specialist in a tertiary teaching hospital. And, you know, in the end, I remember calling the general surgical registrar on call because this patient had a bowel obstruction, he had a neuro issue, he had, you know, orthopedic issue and a respiratory issue. And it was probably the most stressful day because the patient ultimately passed away at the end of the day. I had my registrar come out and just sit down and counsel me because it wasn't just I had a difficult patient. I was having difficulties getting help, you know, at an appropriate time. And I was constantly going, could I have done better for this patient? And, you know, to have my registrar sit down and say no, there were several factors that the patient would never have made it from this fall, made it, well, I was feeling horrible. At least I, you know, got up to live through another day and came back to, you know, like obviously, you know, was able to care for my other patients as well as him. So that was a really stressful day for me as an intern. And these things do happen to patients, and particularly in surgery when you have so many competing demands and needing to prioritize, you know, which patient is your most urgent and which patients can wait is a day in, day out activity. So I think if junior doctors didn't have support, it can become really stressful. And that's the thing to understand as a surgeon, that if your registrar is not available as a consultant, that it's your job to provide that service for the hospital that you work in. So that's something that I keep in mind because it can get quite scary on the ground.
I love the fact that your registrar took you aside and showed some insight into your how you possibly were feeling, compassion, and that sort of thing you then would take into your interactions with others. That is a way of building collegiality between students, trainees, accomplished long-term surgeons. Is that something that you find happens more these days?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're sort of more aware of the need to debrief after a stressful event, and also being able to talk through that event and discuss it at departmental MDTs. They're really important things to learn lessons out of the out of each case. Whether it was a stressful case that went well or didn't go well, it's important to discuss it. And then if there's any, you know, case-specific learning, that's obviously something that you do as a department. But and also if there's any system-specific issues that can be rectified to prevent a future complication, that then needs to be dealt with. So as head of department at the SAN of ENT, it's something that, you know, I really take seriously because we're getting busier and busier. And we do have, you know, our registrars sometimes do see some harrowing cases. And then it's really important to make sure as the head of department that you support the juniors as much as we can.
You mentioned earlier on that when you considered being a surgeon, that there are only a very few women in your group going through with you that considered that. Looking back over some of your work today, one of the words that keeps coming up to me is advocacy. And you are a very strong advocate for a lot of things, but women in medicine is one thing you're particularly passionate about.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't want the barriers that I faced to be faced by others. I have a daughter, and if, you know, it doesn't matter what field of career that she chooses, I don't want her to be facing those barriers. And it is quite obvious to me that those barriers are not going to be going away without active work. Early in my career, when I came back as a fellow, and I started out at the SAN, I did a Women in Leadership course, and I had the opportunity to meet women in leadership positions outside medicine through that course. What was so obvious to me is the same barriers that I perceived in surgery, in medicine, was systemic. So I knew that this is not just a surgery-specific problem. Later on, when I was chair of the State Committee of the College of Surgeons, when we hosted Women in Surgery event, the things that the female fellows were saying, that the barriers that we're encountering, were exactly the same barriers I faced nearly a decade ago.
Two examples?
The main thing that we wanted to work on was access to the public hospital system, you know, or being told that this job is not for you. You've been, you know, someone's been promised this job. Some women were also being told that, you know, you guys have less complications, you're going to take over our world. And as if that was a reason to, you know, to discriminate against them. It's like, gosh, you can be too good or you can, you know, be not good enough. It's never in between. So I think that just, you know, we have such a long way to go in any form of equity in surgery. If we weren't going to be the people finding the solutions, no one is going to find that for us. So it's important as women, and particularly when there are male champions around, to take that up as a free pass and work as hard as you can to change the system.
In what ways do you start to do that?
For myself, I've done a lot through the College of Surgeons because there was, I mean, that's what attracted me to work through the college. The college has had a huge culture shift and is sort of a peak body in terms of advocacy. And then, of course, through hospitals that we've done so much work at the SAN and also other hospitals that I work in, such as RPA.
And it seems to me your work about championing women and encouraging them to pursue medicine or things like science, technology, engineering, mathematics starts much sooner than medical school or trainees. It starts with young women in school.
Yep.
I've seen you to lead some STEM classes for students, and the joy that you see on the face of a young girl or her eyes light up when they hear you speak and see the possibilities. Describe what that's like for you.
I think engaging the school students is like, I've had days where I've, you know, had to do a talk for a bunch of school students, then gone out of that meeting, then had to do something for a minister. And I must say, no offense to the minister, but engaging the school students is so much more enjoyable. It's a blank palette, and, you know, kids don't have those barriers that you develop as you go, you know, further on, or these perceptions because somebody else has told you. And so to be able to get them early to sort of kind of say, well, you know, everyone's equal, this is what you can do, is really empowering for me to know that, you know, that's where they start. And then you take that energy and you put it into the medical student's mind and then the senior colleague's mind to say, well, the school students can do this. This is the future. This is what we need to do. I think it's really effective. You're seeing young girls being taught leadership skills, young boys being taught leadership skills. The values of respect and integrity and kindness is being taught front and center. It wasn't really a thing when I was going through school. So I do hope that, you know, that sort of paints the palette for a better world and a more tolerant world, more collaborative world in the future.
You were the chair of the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons New South Wales Committee in 2020-22, right in the midst of COVID. That's a whole other story, but how unusual was it for a woman to be the chair and an ENT surgeon?
I believe I was the first ENT surgeon to be in that position and the second woman to be in that position.
And how long has the Australasian College of Surgeons been going for? Probably decades and decades.
Yeah, of course. Often on committees, on college committees, there's a huge representation of general surgeons because it is our biggest workforce. The subspecialties have a lower representation, but the strength that we had at the time, I was the chair and the deputy chair, Dr. Mish Atkinson, who's the current chair, was an orthopaedic surgeon. So ENT and orthopaedics were two of the biggest specialties affected by COVID because of the elective nature of our care of services. And it was actually really advantageous to have two subspecialists in that role. So it ended up becoming an advantage, but it wasn't by design.
What are some of the things that you took out of that role that particularly challenging during COVID that you would encourage others when they're reflecting on putting their hands up for roles that big? What would you say to them?
I had been part of the state committee for 6 years prior to that role, so I understood the core business of the college quite well coming into it. I didn't feel unprepared to be taking on that role, and I was deputy chair before I became chair. But I think the thing that was quite nerve-wracking was COVID itself and not having a playbook of what the expectations were as chair in that role. But when I, one of the very early conversations with one of the deputy secretaries in an area of health in a meeting was, you know, when I sort of said, oh, I'm the new incoming chair and having this, I drew the short straw kind of lead into it. He's just said, look, this is a 1 in 100 year opportunity to define your leadership. What you do now is going to either make or break you. And that sort of really changed the frame of mind to something to embrace rather than something to avoid. So that was a really positive way of looking at it. The thing was, nobody else knew. Nobody else had a playbook either. And so it actually opened up an immense amount of collaboration because people came to the table to say, you know what, we don't know, but we're really happy to hear from you and you can hear from us and maybe, you know, we can work out a solution together. And the good thing was that conversation didn't stop after the first wave. In fact, you kept innovating throughout. And that, again, that having that innovative mindset all through health was the thing that, you know, as the state, as New South Wales, what we want to do is, you know, come out of this as a stronger health system. And that core sort of focus has enabled more and more collaborative initiatives in surgery, which has been a really positive aspect out of it. But for me, at the very, that very early conversation about changing it from a challenge to an opportunity was a real critical shifting moment.
You mentioned someone spoke to you about it to approach this as an opportunity. How important has it been to you as a young woman to have colleagues, men and women, particularly men who champion women in medicine and in particularly in leadership roles?
Really, really important. And when we find those champions, or when I identify those champions, I really tell them the impact that they have on the work that we do as women and as advocates. Because when I, you know, build panels in, I try and pull those champions in as much as possible because it just creates a not a conversation of me and them. It creates a conversation of us as a community. What can we do stronger? I cannot emphasize how important it is to have those male champions. And when you find them, you have to make them visible and give them a microphone.
And what has it taught you about when you then speak to medical students about that very thing?
Well, I think the focus is, firstly, whenever you deal with this, you've got to make sure you keep the focus on the patient. You keep the focus on the health system and you keep the focus on the positives of diversity and the resilience of a workforce by having diversity. And if you start with that as your purpose, the impact that you want to have, and then work backwards and how you want to achieve it, then there's obviously a personal impact of that on the female medical student in the audience who's sort of thinking, how can I do this? Should I do this? What are my barriers going to be? But, you know, what are we here for, really? We're here to improve patient care. We want to serve the community. So if we start off with that, it really helps pull everybody else together, man, women, senior person or a junior person.
And I think it perhaps is an example for other men who perhaps haven't spoken up as a champion for women to see someone leading in that way.
Yeah.
That's been your experience?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it has a transformational impact on the culture of whichever institution you're in.
One of the things that intrigued me is how do you choose your specialty? The things that make up your decision to go into a subspecialty, how hard is that?
I think like everything in life, whether it's surgery or just any profession, it's your experiences. Well, it may have something to do with the science of the specialty, but it might just be about, you know, the people you meet alongside, which make you think that, well, you know, I'd really like to be like that person. Personally, I loved anatomy when I was going through med school, and I had some amazing anatomy lecturers who invited me to lecture when I was in year four, between year four to year six in med school. And I really liked the complex anatomy, which was head and neck. And then as I was going through med school to meet surgeons, I had some amazing head and neck surgeons who would take us for tutorials. And in fact, because I'd get the anatomy right, they would be like, you should be a surgeon. Your anatomy is really great. You know, you beat everybody in the class. And that sort of made me think, yes, I really love this. And then when I started looking into head and neck surgery options, there were general surgeons who I was approaching. They said, look, think about ENT. It's growing. There's, you know, microscopic surgery, endoscopic surgery, open surgery. These are things that's going to continue to change. And that obviously I had an interest in technology, and that sort of really attracted me. And then I met some ENT surgeons who just were really key mentors in my life in doing not just ENT but otology. So it's often the people you meet along the way who inspire you, that helps you craft what you want to do. And then, of course, you've got to, you know, love the craft, which I did, and find the why in it for you. And I love the fact that we look at to treat patients, children and adults. It's just such a, it's had such a huge variety for me, and there's a huge amount of unknowns that you can do research in this area forever. So, yeah.
Because people think when pressured to find a subspecialty, it scares them because they think, oh, that's very narrowing. But you can choose a subspecialty, like you were saying, it is very broad. There are so many offerings within that subspecialty. So it isn't necessarily a narrowing thing. It can be very broad.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is the thing, like, you know, when we think of a subspecialty, we often think, oh, well, look at ophthalmology. It's one organ. But I can tell you, like, having worked at the Sydney Eye Hospital as an intern, I didn't realize how many subspecialties within ophthalmology there are. Like, how can you subdivide into one organ in so many areas? But there are. So what we think of as narrow is actually when you get to the science and the art of the actual craft, it can be quite variable.
And sounds like you could choose an area that really piques your interest and run with it, and it could be a very rewarding career. You're an ear, nose and throat specialist. What surprised you most about your ENT specialty that you hadn't really considered before your training?
I had not appreciated how many unknowns there are. I've seen known unknowns, and then there's lots of unknown unknowns. And, you know, each day, surprising how much more there is to learn. And I think the part that's what's attracted me into academia as well, being able to solve those clinical challenges for my patients. Sometimes we're at the limit of our clinical experience, but to be able to then work with interdisciplinary teams, with engineers, with scientists, and kind of go, look, we can't go forward any further in our current practice. Can we take this to the bench, solve a problem, and then being able to translate to the patients and coming back to the patient? Sometimes it's, you know, 6-7 years later to say, you started this journey for me. This is where we're up to. And even if it doesn't solve the problem for that patient, it's incredibly rewarding to be able to communicate to them because they see that somebody else might benefit from that contribution.
Did the idea of being an ENT surgeon live up to the reality in ways that you talked about academia, but also in the area of inventions and innovation? Was that a surprise to you?
Yes, thinking back so many, just more than a decade ago, at the time, I thought this was, you know, very innovative in its way. And now you sort of look back on it and you think, wow, that was so archaic that we were doing. It's interesting. I was currently just this week, I was getting my registrar to look at an ethics application for a new study that we want to do at the SAN in ergonomics of surgery using robotic microscopes. And I dug up a essay that I wrote 11 years ago when I was doing my master's surgery on microsurgery and the history of microsurgery and talk about the ergonomics, how it's so good. And I was referencing my then mentor who was retiring, who had sort of set up Otology. And I was reading this essay because I was going to give it to him as, you know, background reading, and just sort of think about, wow, we've come so far. That is just, you know, just it's what makes for me the specialty so exciting, that there is just, we don't know what we don't know. And technology has changed so much, you know, that the exponential rate at which technology is coming at us. And to be able to have that adaptive mindset, to be able to put the governance and research around it, you know, it's a really exciting place for me to be.
Your students that you teach must love hearing this, because there's so a much broader horizons to medicine now than perhaps even when they went into it, you know, a few years ago. Is that something that you enjoy, just sparking that interest that this is almost a limitless field of innovation, of doing things better for the patient, for the surgeon, for the practice of medicine?
You know, it's something that I've realized, that there are no formal channels to teach that diversity, to open those horizons, but it's present all around us. So it's something that I actively try to do because it's not in the curriculum. What our curriculum for teaching, particularly surgical trainees, is the core craft of surgery. But I launched a statewide research program in ENT in collaboration with a colleague of mine named Professor Gordon Wallace last year. And that engages a breadth of scientists and surgeons across the state. But it was to overcome this barrier that I don't think that we are interdisciplinary we don't teach interdisciplinary skills to be able to work across, not just, yeah, I have a problem, let's find an engineer who can solve that problem, but we're operating, but we actually don't understand the impact of the cost on the health economics because we don't have those skills. We're never taught those skills. And what we found from, you know, COVID, there are a huge amount of, you know, we live in a resource-limited world, and unless we are able to work collaboratively across different disciplines, we don't have a sustainable future to be able to maximize the opportunities for our patients. So it's interesting you ask that question. It's not just a passion project. It is an absolute reality that I am trying to instill in our students, that ability to find help when they have a problem.
You seem to have found a remarkable way to combine being a surgeon and being an academic and research. Medical students probably think of the old-fashioned, what we see on the media, as stuck in a laboratory in the dark, never seeing people, patients, whatever. You sound like you've combined surgery and academia in a really exciting way, and drawing in, it's not a dark laboratory somewhere, it is, you're working with engineers, you're working with technology companies, you're working with startups and investors, you're working with government, with policymakers. You seem to be able to bring those teams together almost effortlessly, some of those who never talked to each other before. What gave you that idea, and how do you pull it off?
The first thing to realize is your limitations, to know that you're not an expert, but also to understand what skills you have that's valuable to a collaborator. Earlier in my career, I was that person in the lab interacting with scientists and realizing that I can work with my scientists to give them the clinical application of why we need to, that technology needs to be driven by the clinical application, not the other way around. And then, of course, in my role as being the state committee chair in New South Wales, which happened to coincide with the 1-in-100-year pandemic, which really sort of then opened up my collaborations. We're all domain experts in our world, but to have developed an understanding and passion for the health system and seeing all the broad things in the health system, which is so important to actually, you know, when you bring it back to research, it's so important to have that visibility to make sure that your research is ultimately going to end up with the patient, but not just get it to the patient, but get it to the patient in a most cost-effective manner. So it's not just one patient you can touch, but as many patients as possible, not just in Australia, you know, in Africa, in everywhere in the world. And so that equity lens was really built in, and that's really helped me be passionate that we need to have that big picture view and combine that with the, you know, the microscopic, you know, the expertise that we have in our own domain. And in a way, you know, the digital world of virtual meetings is such a liberator of those barriers. And to be able to enhance that has really enabled me to, you know, bring those people in. And I'm a good storyteller. And I, being a hearing surgeon, I have the ability of getting into people's ears.
So, literally.
So I use those skills.
Because some of those people you work with are traditionally in silos. And we look after our own silo and we have a very limited pool of money and resources and people. And you seem to blow those barriers away and find some, I don't know, some compelling hook to get people to work together. What's your secret?
You know, go back to, I know my limitations, but at the same time, the focus is on impact. And I'm reading this thing about different mindsets and, you know, you can, and then COVID was a really great example where you had this, the problem mindset where, you know, we have a problem, we don't really know what to do with it. And then some people kind of went, oh, okay, I'm going to grow out of it. But in health, what we saw the most effective mindset to have was an innovative mindset to use COVID as an opportunity to innovate. I find that that mindset is really, really attracts people because there are a lot of other people who are also excited by innovation. And sometimes innovation might not mean making a robot and, you know, it might mean changing a care model to increase impact. But if we keep the focus on the impact that we want to have on the community around us and mostly, you know, our patients and then work backwards, it's amazing how compelling it is because everyone else has the same vision. And so people often are then, you know, prepared to lay their guards and their boundaries of the silos that they have behind to want to collaborate to create a better world.
How would you get through to a medical student who's perhaps struggling between combining surgery and a fulfilling career in medicine? You've been able to do that. Are there misconceptions that a career in surgery and a career in research and academia are incompatible?
I think that is definitely a misconception. I've just come back a few weeks ago from the American Academic Surgery meeting. And, you know, we think, oh, God, it's hard in Australia. We don't really have that bigger community, so we don't have visibility. But there were 2,000 academic surgeons in this meeting. I was blown away by the scale of the community there. So, like, let's just use that as a reference to say, no, it's not impossible. In fact, it's common. What we don't understand when we look at surgery is when you have that clinical only model of, of a surgeon, that's their choice. That's not how you have to be. You don't have to be 100% clinical. You can be, you know, whatever fraction of your time you want to commit to being on a board, to doing philanthropy. In fact, when we look at the RACS data, 2/3 of surgeons do something, you know, spend, you know, 20 to 40% of their time doing something else, whether that's in education, whether it's in health administration, whether it's in research, or global surgery, like traveling and doing relief work.
In what ways for you did being an academic complement or improve or help you as a surgeon and vice versa?
Oh, it's absolutely improved my ability as a surgeon. I wouldn't do it if it didn't make me a better surgeon, not just to try and find better ways to do things, but it always makes me challenge the status quo. In my clinical practice, it forces me to measure what I'm doing. The governance of running research grants, that teaches me accountability and measuring what I do and therefore my interventions and therefore changing what I do if I feel that they're not effective.
And you talked earlier on about how collegiality is important in working with other faculties, inside and outside of medicine, government, all aspects working together on a common goal. One of the things that you're really passionate about is new ears. Can you tell us a bit about that and how collaboration was important in that?
Yeah. Again, my PhD was in looking at 3D technologies in the translation of treating ear disorders. Where we started off was the easiest application of that, which was a condition called microtia. Microtia is a congenital condition where the outer ear, the pinna, the bit that we wear earrings on, so important, is not formed well. And so often these patients also have a hearing deformity that goes on just because the ossicles and the hearing bones in the ear, they have not really formed. there are ways, there are implantable devices where you can overcome that hearing deficit. But the ability to reconstruct the ear, which plastic surgeons often do, that is really fraught with difficulty. And it's, we still, you know, use rib cartilage as donor cartilage from children to harvest, which is quite challenging and has, you know, donor site morbidity, and results are not so good. So I thought that that would be the best place to start for this technology called bioprinting, which is 3D printing with cartilage. And that research is currently in animal trials, but it was really a conversation with a patient to say, you know, I use 3D printing to solve the solution of his hearing implant because I was trying to plan what type of hearing implant. And he's like, well, can you do something about the rest of my ear? And that sort of started off this project, this new interventions in ear research. And that's now, you know, we're trying to develop a program around regenerating hearing bones, so ossicles, again, very patient-driven, clinical challenges-driven, and then hopefully in the future sort of work towards printing neurons, cochlear neurons and balanced neurons, and studying on human models our treatments, so our drugs, but also devices to understand our interventions. Currently, you know, the only thing we can do is look at animal studies, but animal physiology and human physiology is completely different. So we do all of these animal experiments, but then they don't translate well to humans, and then we don't understand why they don't work. So there's, yeah, so much work ahead.
So you're not only trying to bioprint a physical outer ear, you're trying to bioprint cartilage for the inner ear down to the neuron level?
Yeah, so bioprinting is the method, but you can print whatever you want to. So the current project in printing the outer ear is printing cartilage, but we want to do some work with a head and neck colleague who's interested in printing bone for jaw reconstruction. And, you know, we're trying to bounce off some of that work to be able to print perhaps ossicles for hearing reconstruction, but that's a very different type of tissue. And then I know that there's, you know, this morning even we were talking about some colleagues who work in printing neurons for balance, so inner ear cells, hearing neurons and cochlear neurons and balanced neurons, and then to be able to, you know, as a clinician sort of, you know, piggyback off that research to go, okay, now we're going to test our interventions and see which interventions work. So the clinical trials that we're gearing up to run at the SAN, we want to make sure that those clinical trials, we're not just sort of the bits that we don't understand in the clinical trials, we can then take it to the bench and try those interventions on the human neurons that we can print and just kind of go, well, did it not work because of this one, two, three variables? But we can test that much more methodically on the bench that we can test it, obviously, in patients. So that gives the patients who are participating in the clinical trials so much more confidence that they know why it worked and why it didn't work if it did.
So down the track, we're looking at not only improving the aesthetics, the appearance of the outer ear, so people can be really comfortable and pleased with the way they look, and also it impacts their ability to hear and also balance. How far down the track are we from these being used to benefit patients?
The aspect with the cartilage printing, so there are clinical trials already underway in the world. So we know that even our research, the Australian research, is still in animal trials. So we know that that's actually very close to being implemented in patients. So the technology is very close to translation. The other aspects of it, you know, the implementation in ossicles or in, you know, in the inner ear, that's just in development phase. So it's probably going to be 5 to 10 years before that comes into clinical trial phase.
And it sounds like the field is almost endless when you're talking about a surgeon is doing it for reconstruction of jaw. How did you get into this field, and how did 3D printing, bioprinting capture your imagination?
Through my daughter, believe it or not. So I had these clinical problems, but then I took my daughter to watch Big Hero 6. This is December 2014. I remember it really well. And I was watching this kid, you know, it was like this futuristic animation. I was watching this kid 3D print, you know, the armor on its AI robot. And I was like, wow, I wonder if you can apply this technology in medicine. And at that time, 3D printing was quite a new thing in medicine. So I came back and I started sort of looking at the research out there and sort of realized that there were actually colleagues here in New South Wales who are world experts in this research, But they were doing it in other areas. So in cartilage regeneration arthritis and pancreatic research, there wasn't anybody applying it in ENT. So that's what started my journey in this. And I was curious about applying this technology. The 3D printing aspect of this technology was very much that, you know, I could solve a patient problem today, but the bioprinting aspect really needed take it to the lab, do it on a bench, and then slowly progress that from in vitro to, you know, animal work and eventually, you know, build the system around it. So there's a lot of work during this time in regulation that didn't used to exist in custom-made, you know, products. That led me to doing a lot of work on regulatory aspects of 3D printing and working with policymakers to make it sort of, you know, that there weren't barriers for translation. And that's why I then put my hand up to be on the advisory committee for medical devices of the TGA. And so there are things that you do that starts you off on a journey. You don't know you're going to go there, but then you start engaging with the different aspects of our healthcare service just due to the experiences that you've had.
And that brings us to your advocacy again. So you've gone from seeing a program on TV and an idea, working on that, and now you're advocating for that and getting it through the regulatory hoops that will help it become a reality. Is this an area of ENT specialty that really excites you about the future?
Yeah, I mean, in this conversation, it's not just the stuff that we're doing now, but it's just so many opportunities of the future that's available for us to do things better. You know, in this journey as a researcher, just sort of coming across these things and talking, learning to talk to stakeholders in our research world by chance, that's what sort of links you back to the problem. There's actually no learning mechanism. Like, we're all doing this through our experiences, which means that we as a country, we're translating our research slowly. But if we could actually, you know, connect the dots, so to speak, for the next generation and make that network available to them early, you know, maybe they don't have to spend 10 years doing the research and then working out, oh, well, this doesn't have regulatory approval. Where do we go? Our system is going to be better able to support them because they have more visibility of those translational hurdles. So I am incredibly excited for the future, not just for our next generation, but also our system, because it's just evolving really rapidly and it's very collaborative.
From a lot of things you've said, it's really clear that you thrive on thinking outside the square. It'd be hard to take that idea and turn it into reality. To what do you credit your ability to bring people alongside with you on a dream and then becomes a reality?
Being a woman. And it's not just, it's not a joke. I've reflected on this a lot. And I think, you know, as a woman going through surgery, being not a, you know, there has been many barriers, right? And now reflecting back on them, I really want to thank those people who created those barriers for me, because every time the door was shut, I had to go through the path less traveled to find a way to solve my problems. And in that journey, I discovered new roads and new doors that were opened. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I was the typical, you know, male colleague where my career set out of me and all I'd know is surgery and all I do is surgery. So if it wasn't for those barriers that I encountered in my early career as a female, that I would not have understood the power of innovation. So, yeah, thank you to those who made it, you know, to all those doors that were shut in the face, you know, there was a big reason to my success that it contributed for.
One of the things I saw looking at one of your talks was the legacy from your parents and grandparents. And some of the things you've been talking about your advocacy, about your not accepting a shut door, it seems to me to come from a very deep place that your parents and grandparents have left you. Can you tell us a little bit about the freedom fighter that seems to come out in you every now and then that is actually in your DNA?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really grounds you in terms of, you often think of these as first world problems, right? Like, My grandparents were brought up at a time where, you know, India was fighting for its independence. So my grandfather was a freedom fighter and, you know, often got put in jail because of and that was sort of the norm for anybody who was fighting for freedom for India at that time. That was my paternal grandfather. My maternal grandmother was also a real advocate. So they lived on the wrong side of India, so in the Bangladesh side of India at the time before partition. And overnight, they lost all of their belongings and had to migrate as refugees on the right side of India just because of their religion. And they saw their house being burgled and, you know, they basically survived by the skin of their teeth. And so then, you know, to start from scratch, and my grandmother was the, you know, eldest daughter in her family and didn't have the opportunities to, you know, with 12 siblings, didn't have the opportunities then as a female to go to school, let alone med school, and she wanted to be a doctor. And then, so if my father was, you know, this was brought up, paid his way through education, through scholarships, because his dad was a freedom fighter and often in jail. And my grandmother wanted to be a doctor and didn't have the opportunity. So both of them have been incredibly influential in my outlook in life and valuing educational opportunities and, you know, valuing opportunity in general. You know, look at the glass half full rather than glass half empty and see what you have to work with when you have a hurdle and see what you can make out of it. And maybe that's, you know, and research is like that. You don't necessarily, it's not what you've started out to do, but, you know, you hit a failure and you learn from the failure and then you might end up somewhere else totally, which is an amazing place in its own, but that's not where you started out. Clinical work is not like that, but that's what research teaches you, that, you know, you actually create something that you not had visibility on it before, but then it goes back to those life skills that your family gave you.
Oh, I'm so glad that there is a bit of a freedom fighter in you, that you have the background that has led you to be such a staunch advocate for women in medicine, for people coming up through the ranks, for social justice, for speaking up, for finding every way around a shut door. We are so privileged to have spent time with you and it's been an absolute honour. I look forward to talking to you again.
It's been so much fun. Thank you so much for having me.